I will be observing Passover for the 53rd time. And I'm not saying that to get into a competition, because I'm sure there's going to be a few of you that have observed Passover for more years than I have. So let's not make it a competition. But as you'll hear today, there are many times in my life and in the Bible that help us to understand that if anything, we can expect the unexpected. Benjamin Franklin said, "By failing to prepare, you prepare to fail." So how can you effectively prepare for Passover? That's my mission today, to help provide some background information, some personal experiences in keeping the Passover, and help you in the next week prepare mentally for the observance of the Passover. And I've told this story before, and it sounds fantastic. I'm going to repeat it again. There are probably many on the online audience who'd never heard it, and I had mentioned it to the people in El Paso last week. I don't think I'd ever told them before, but my first Passover was the spring of 1972. I was in college. I was in my sophomore year of college, so it wasn't like I didn't have anything to do. I didn't have a full-time job, but I did go to class every day, and I didn't have any afternoon classes as I remember that day, so I had plenty of time to get to Passover services, which in rural Maryland was in Hagerstown, or near Hagerstown, Maryland. You can look it up on a map. It's on the western side of a chain of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I lived on the other side, so they're not like the mountains we have here, not as grandiose or big or high, but still mountain roads nonetheless, weaving and winding back and forth. So a 15-mile drive usually takes 45 minutes because of all the twists and the turns and the nooks and crannies of the road and going over the Blue Ridge Mountains. So I gave myself plenty of time to get to the Passover service, which probably was conducted at 7 o'clock or 7:30 that night. I don't remember when sundown was. But I made my way carefully to our local church hall, and it's a rural area. It was past Hagerstown, a little bit further west of Hagerstown, our local meeting hall, and I drove up, and there is nobody there. And then it dawned on me, they had changed the location for Passover to another Grange Hall, which actually was closer to where I lived, but still on the western side of the Blue Ridge Mountains. So I had a little Volkswagen, 1964 Volkswagen Bug, and I drove as fast as I could lawfully to get there, and I just barely made it. And I think it was 7:30 was the time of the service, and they were ready to lock the doors, and as I walked in, one of the ushers says, "Man, you just made it," and whispered very quietly to me. And so like we do at the Passover, my first Passover, there's so many, when you're first coming into the church, you're learning about so many different things, right? It's coming at you like water out of a fire hydrant, so to speak. You're just learning, and, you can't absorb everything in one go, so we rehearse, the holy times, holy day times, basically the same things year by year, the seven annual holy day seasons. And so, I'd been prepared a little bit by my brother and by other members as to what to expect, but it was the first thing I noticed, everything was super quiet. Everybody was sitting, and they had their Bibles open, and they're all just poring over their Bibles. So it wasn't, they were doing this, and so I did that too. I didn't know what to look at, but I started opening the Bible and reading it. So, but I was, I was pretty brand new. I'd been baptized only in January of that year. And, but you learn by doing, right? That's part of the process of coming into the church. You learn by doing, and I was learning by doing and experiencing and being taught by others and, having some good peers and good mentors like my brother and others whom I respected within the local congregation, teaching and helping and just by example, providing a good example. But I noticed something that was different than any other service that I had participated in, and I'd been attending since November of the previous year in 1971. And I've told this story to you, and some of you may remember it, some of you haven't heard it, but the thing that I noticed as people are quietly reading their Bibles and ready for the minister to begin is We couldn't see the minister. We couldn't see the stage. The entire stage was, it was kind of an amateurish way of doing it, but as I remember, some of you don't even know what clothespins are, but you know, before dryers came along, people hung their clothes out to dry with clothespins, and the whole front of the stage was covered in sheeting. I mean, like bed sheets, and they were clipped together, and so this mass of white encircled the stage. In fact, I didn't even know there was a stage. I mean, there was a rise level, but it was all cut off by sheets. Now, my brother, when he was alive, he disputed this with me. He was at the same service. He says, "Steve, that is your imagination. You know what you're talking about." I said, "How can I make this up? How could I come up with something this zany?" And it was zany, but to me, it was normal. Because I was attending a brand new church, I was keeping the Sabbath, that was, you know, first thing that's a little bit out of line with most other churches, and I was now keeping and observing the Passover, which is different than anybody else does, right? And so, to me, it was completely, I noticed it was, but I thought, well, that's, you know, there's got to be some correlation with the Bible there or something, and then the minister began the thing, and that was eerie. Because it was like the voice coming from the great beyond somehow, or from the middle of the Holy of Holies or something. It was like, this is okay, but this is normal for me. It's totally, totally normal, because this is the only Passover I'd ever experienced. And so we went through the Passover service. The usher who had told me I just barely made it, I remember him quite distinctly. He was the individual's. He and I are the ones who wash feet. Now, the other 50 so times, I don't remember everybody's feet that I washed, but through the years, but there's been over 50 others. But I remember that one because it was my first one. And I also remember my second one. Now, this is where it got, you know, as I look back, this is where it really gets interesting for me. I am now a college student in England, keeping the Passover at the Ambassador College campus in Brickett Wood, about 20 miles north of London, 25 miles north of London. And I was on the setup crew for the Sabbath. That was a voluntary crew where we set up the chairs in the gymnasium. It was a very large gymnasium. And that's where we had weekly services. That's where we had Bible study. That's where we met for all holy days. And there's probably, I'd have to ask, Steve could probably tell me later about how many people we had on average. Sometimes every year they had two services. Maybe, I don't know if we had morning and afternoon services. We did in Big Sandy for a while, was there. But anyway, probably with the seating on the floor, I don't know, maybe 800, 900 people. Passover would be a little bit less. But I used to set up. We used to set up the chairs on the basketball floor, roll the bleachers back, and have plenty of room, and there's a lot of people in there. So, and we put tarps down on the floor to protect the wooden basketball court and everything, set the chairs on them. But I walked over from the dormitory, I think I walked across the grass or walked on the sidewalk over to the hall, and my second Passover, and I know a little bit more about what's going on in the church, okay? I'd gone through the summer in my local church, gone to Ambassador College. Now, I've been there for half a year or so, a semester and a little bit more than that. And it's April of 1973, and I walked into the gym, and it was set up with a lectern on the stage, just like this, just like the one you in the hall are seeing, just basically like this. And I'm thinking, where are the sheets? What are they trying to do here? What are they breaking with tradition somehow? I mean, what's going on? I mean, it just didn't compute to me, because I'm thinking, this is different. This is not right. I mean, where are the sheets? Why can I see the lectern? And so then, the minister got up, one of the ministers that had been around for a long time there in England, and he was an American, and he began in conducting the Passover service, and we went through the service and went through the foot washing, and it was all fine, but it just, in my head, what's going on here? Why are they doing something different in England than they're doing in America? Of course, my American experience was an N of one. But I thought that was the norm. So you can imagine my confusion, and I have no idea why the local minister decided to do that for drama or effect or whatever, but obviously he was the one that was, in my home area, he was the one that was doing it like a little different than anybody else would. I don't know what his reasons were. Nobody ever explained it to him. My brother disputes it, but we'll settle this at the resurrection and talk about it. I do remember whose feet I washed, and that was my German instructor. I got paired up with him as we're walking back to the, they lined up chairs around the Olympic-sized swimming pool in the other part of the gymnasium complex, and you know, the men went into the area of the pool. We're lined up just as we do for the foot washing everywhere, and he and I got paired up together. He was my German instructor, and in fact, I saw him again last year. He was visiting his sister in the United States, and he came to El Paso and gave a sermon. He's a minister in Bricketwood, England, still, and it was good to see him. So, but I remember that, and I have fond memories of him calling me into his office at the beginning of my sophomore year and said, "We've decided to waive the language requirement for you, so you're welcome." So I was so happy about that day. Anyway, so last week, or 2 weeks ago now, I explained the history of the Passover and why the teaching from Exodus 12 is so important. And today, I'd like to highlight our responsibility for preparing individually for the Passover. Let's begin in Exodus chapter 12, and beginning in verse 3. And I'm not going to read verses 3 through 11, all of them, but I'll let the guys know where they're turning the scriptures to when I deviate. But I want to begin with God's instruction to Moses that he was going to give to the children of Israel. He said, "Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons, according to each man's need. You shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, etc., etc., etc. And keep it till the 14th day in verse 6, as we know. And then other instructions. And then let's move on down to verse 11, where it says, "And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." So from the earliest account of Passover, we see the need expressed to be prepared and to be ready. This was a physical thing, and there they had very specific instructions as to the type of sacrifice, how large it would be, how old it would be. Particularly, it would be without blemish, to picture and to symbolize the ultimate sacrifice, Jesus Christ, could be kept with neighbors. So they had a certain amount of time that they would have to make these adjustments, and beginning with the 10th of the month, they would have to begin planning and preparing at least in that. So they had plenty of opportunity to understand that they were to be prepared. And the point is, they prepared, we prepare. So just as ancient Israel, our preparation is also necessary for keeping the New Testament Passover. So let's go to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 17. While I'm going over this instruction, I'd like to go over something that is often comes up as a question, oftentimes comes up as a question about the timing issue and all of that, because it can be confusing. And just reading this in Matthew 26 and verse 17. "Now on the first day of the feast of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying to him, 'Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?'" Now, virtually everybody here in this audience and everybody listening online, or mostly everybody, unless you're a newbie like I was in 1971 and 1972, realize that the Passover is kept on the 14th and then the days of unleavened bread on the 15th. So this says they came to him on the first day of the feast of unleavened bread, but the Passover would have already been over by then. right? You catch that, right? But let's take a look. In most of your Bibles, you'll notice that from day to feast is italicized. That means it wasn't a part of the original Greek. It was added, hopefully, to be a clarifying measure. In this case, it didn't add any clarification. It helps add to the confusion of the timing of the issue. But they knew about the Feast of Unleavened Bread from other passages, but as you know, the Passover comes before the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So what's the answer to this problem where the translators tried to help clear it up by adding in some other words that aren't in the original text, or you know, they don't translate in English from Greek to English that way? Now, first of all, there's no Greek word for feast, okay? The literal translation here is the first of unleavens. The first of unleavens. So at the time of the first unleavens, actually before the time of the first unleavens, they were going to eat that evening. It was the daytime portion of the 13th. But as I explained several weeks ago in speaking about every incidence of the Passover that is recorded, I think we covered all of them, every incidence of Passover that is recorded in the Old Testament beginning with Exodus 12, we find, and actually, if we'll go back, guys, I put this in my notes, but maybe I didn't put it. So in Exodus, if we could just switch from Matthew to Exodus 12 and verse 8, if we could do that, if you could flash back to Exodus chapter 12 and verse 8. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, this is Exodus 12, roasted with fire, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, they shall eat it. So on the Passover, at the beginning of Passover day and the evening, between the evenings, at sunset, right after sunset, and you know, as they were preparing dinner, this is what they were to eat, unleavened bread with the Passover sacrifice. Some have tried to argue that, no, they must have had other bread or whatever, but no, it's unleavened. So we don't celebrate the 8 days of unleavened bread because that's not what it's called, but obviously in Egypt, they were getting ready and they would be leaving the next night, and so they are told to keep unleavened bread, not just as a type of, you know, not just as another day of unleavened bread, but because that is symbolic of no sin, right? As we know from 1 Corinthians 5 and elsewhere. Leaven is a type of sin. Unleavened is a type of righteousness for this time only. So they're going to eat that evening as they are preparing on the daytime portion of the 13th, which would precede Passover. This is how they are told by Jesus to prepare. So going on back to Matthew chapter 26, and we'll begin in verse 18 now, in 26 and verse 18. And he said, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. So the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover. And in verse 20, when evening had come, that means at the beginning of the day, as God counts days, he sat down with the 12. Now, as they were eating, he said, assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Now, the point of this part of the sermon is to show that disciples also had their part in preparation for the Passover. They were to do certain things. Jesus Christ gave them an assignment, and they fulfilled that assignment. There are those in that household who fulfilled their assignment of having a Passover meal, traditionally as it was, kept for, well, we don't know exactly how long, but I went through all of the examples in the Old Testament. We can see that oftentimes even the Jews, who at least retained a knowledge of the Sabbath, for hundreds of years at times didn't keep the Passover, or didn't keep it correctly as it is explained in Exodus 12. We went through that. But the disciples had their share in planning this first New Testament Passover. So in the sermon a few weeks ago, we went through all the instances, the Old Testament Passover. You saw that even the tribe of Judah concerning the Passover, the only examples we are given that it was kept were during And there could have been more, we don't know, but the only ones that are recorded for us are at times when it was discovered again, like during the time of Hezekiah, all right? And then later on during the times of Josiah. And then the next time is during the time when the second temple was built and Haggai and Zechariah were present there. So we see those distinct revivals under Hezekiah, Josiah, and when the second temple was built about 516 BC. But at other times, we have an absence of evidence as the record. But in Ezra chapter 6 and verse 19, this is the last recorded incident in which the Jews had come out of captivity. Why did they go into captivity in the first place? From Babylon, because they disobeyed God. And they'd forgotten a lot of things about their culture and about the law of God. And they became disobedient to God. And they were told, you know, if they continued, and they had God sent prophets to them to repent, repent. And of course, they eventually went into captivity in Babylon. And the reason for that is because of lack of obedience, not just because they're bad people, but because they didn't obey the commands that God had given. And the other tribes had gone into captivity 120 years or so earlier than that. But in Ezra 6 and verse 19, the descendants of the captivity, now over, almost 100 years after those captivities began, about 516 BC, the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. Hallelujah. They got it right. They kept it at the right time. They discovered the law. They discovered that they had sinned as a people, and their historical antecedents had sinned. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for their brethren, the priests, and for themselves. They did it. Now, we don't see a command of God to saying, okay, you priests, you Levites, I've transferred all that authority from the household to you. But the same thing happened under Hezekiah and Josiah. Why? Well, I think we can make the reasonable assumption that because there is no transference of authority from the head of the household to the priesthood for such a thing, there are some questionable ideas that people have brought up. Oh, thank you. I guess I am thirsty. So I think we can make the reasonable assumption that because they had lost virtually everything else and even the knowledge of the Passover, that God allowed the priests and the Levites on these three separate times to do that responsibility, because that's, you know, during the daily sacrifices, the holy day sacrifices, that's what they would be doing anyway. But we don't see any admonishment to do away with what was originally given in Exodus 12. But I think that you can also make the reasonable assumption that since they hadn't obeyed the original instructions in Exodus 12 for many years, and maybe, you know, from the time of entering into the land, because the one I left out, I think, Joshua's time, when they went into the land, they kept the Passover then. That may have been the one I left out of the sermon several weeks ago. But they still kept it according to the instruction of Exodus 12. But then later on, they grew apart from God. They disobeyed God. And it seems as though even during the time of Hezekiah, I believe it's Hezekiah, not Josiah, they lost so much knowledge that they didn't even have the priesthood sanctified, the temple cleansed or anything, and they all kept the second Passover. Remember that. We went over that a few weeks ago. They kept the second Passover because they just blown by that first month. And then they didn't discover until, oh, wait a minute, we should have been doing this all along. So perhaps for hundreds of years, they just didn't even follow the original instructions. So Hezekiah prayed for the people. You can read about it in Chronicles. Hezekiah prayed for the people, and God blessed them. You know, sometimes it doesn't give you a carte blanche to do whatever you want. But sometimes attitude is more important. The attitude of the people was more important that time than just making sure that, okay, now wait a minute, we got to get back to this Exodus 12 thing of keeping it in the household. But so you see that they lost so much. I think it's in Josiah's example, though, if you go back, it seems as though Josiah gave 30,000 lambs for the people themselves. So maybe there was kind of a hybrid mix. I wasn't there, but all we have is the record. So, what has changed? And why are you telling us to come here next Friday night as a group? That's where we'll investigate in the rest of the service today. What changed, and why do we do it now as a service? Well, you're telling us that, you know, they had just superseded all of these original instructions in Exodus 12 to do it in a household, and now you're telling us to come together in an entire group for a service? Well, you're not making any sense, Buchanan. Well, a lot of times I don't make any sense, and my wife can verify that. So, but in this case, let's find out why we do keep it as a service, and we don't keep it in our homes in the same way as it's mentioned in Exodus 12. Well, sometimes you can keep it at home some of you may be watching the service online and keeping the Passover in your home. That's fine. There are circumstances that, you know, sometimes demand that that must be done. Let's turn to John chapter 13. John chapter 13. This is, of course, the last Passover Jesus Christ would keep with his disciples. The question is, what has changed? Why does the New Jerusalem Church and why does the Church of God today keep it as a service when I've made so much of an impact in talking about, I haven't made the impact, but Exodus 12 makes the impact that it should be done as a service within the homes. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" You're not going to wash my feet. Not going to allow it. And Jesus answered and said to him, "What I'm doing, you don't understand now." You know, like I didn't understand about the sheets. Still don't. You're going to learn by doing. "What I'm doing, you don't understand now, but you'll know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered him, "If I don't wash you, you have no part with me." You've got to go through that process of cleansing, or you can't be a part of God's kingdom. This example in John 13 is the very first step in establishing a new direction and instruction in keeping the New Testament Passover, and begins to explain why we do keep it as a service today, and how we are to keep it as a service today is further explained elsewhere in the Bible. In verse 14, "If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." That's what we do during Passover. "For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you." Follow that example. When? On the evening of the Passover. Now let's turn to Matthew 26 and verse 26. You could go to other gospel accounts. I decided to stick with Matthew and continue with Matthew's explanation. In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 26, "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed it and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body.' Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins.'" Aha! We're going in a new direction now, not just the blood on the lentils and the doorpost protecting from the death angel, but new symbols that would supersede those originally given in Exodus 12. We don't see an example in the Old Testament of God saying, okay, you've got a tabernacle now, and then you're going to have a temple, so this should be done by the priests. It's not found in the Bible. Now, there is an incident, and I believe it's number 16, but I'm not even going to get into that because it's obviously a chapter which speaks about the days of unleavened bread apart from the Passover. And there's some key words that talk about the types of sacrifices, but you will find no instruction in the Old Testament that supersedes Exodus 12. So it was originally done as a family thing to be taught within the families, and they forgot even that. And then later on, when they had some revivals, it was allowed to be done by the priests. Verse 29 of Matthew 26, I say unto you, I will not drink of the fruit of this vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out from the Mount of Olives. And that is usually the end of our Passover service when we keep it today. So on that evening, whether it was 30 or 31 AD or another date, Jesus changed the symbols of the Passover while they were in this transitional year, this one-time-only time, when he would have his last Passover meal as originally kept and outlined in Exodus 12, as they would have bitter herbs and a lamb, and it would be prepared for them in Jerusalem because they were from northern part of the country, and they were coming down there. Most all of them were Galileans, and they were using a rented house, so to speak. And Christ had it all set up and it all directed, and they had the traditional, I would expect, Exodus 12 type of Passover meal. But after that meal, and during that entire evening, he changed what would be done for Passover. And we find that in the next few verses as well. So let's get into your preparation, and you'll have about a week's time now, right, to get ready for the Passover. And you should prepare, just as everyone through history who has kept and observed the Passover, you should prepare. But now it has to do with a mental preparation. And, there's some physical preparation, as you understand, but there's a lot more of it is important from a mental standpoint. Where do we go? Well, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And it helps outline and give us a debrief on exactly what we should do and how our thought process should proceed in the next few days. Because the Corinthians had problems, and you can see that they had divisions and factions and problems, and Paul mentions that as we're going to get to. They had some misunderstandings, and people left on their own devices can sometimes have misunderstandings, as we know. And that's what happened to them. And somebody somewhere along the line after Paul left started doing things which seemed right to them, apparently. In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 17, he begins to set things straight. Now, in giving these instructions, I do not praise you. You've messed up. Okay? Since you come together not for the better, for the worse. Things are not going in the right direction. I've seen it myself, as I'm going to bring out. For the first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. You know, maybe not everything, but it's obvious that there are issues. For there must be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. One of the most important scriptures or verses about the New Testament Passover, right now, verse 20. Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. How could anything be clearer than that? Well, you know, as many have said through the years, you can't do it because he already did it. You can't eat his supper, he's already eaten his supper. That's not the purpose of Passover, and that is extremely clear. And people have asked, well, you know, why do we keep the Passover different than the Jews? Because they don't keep the Passover. I explained that a couple of weeks ago. I mean, they call it the Passover, and you can call anything you want. You know, I can call my I can call my Ford Fusion a Mercedes, but that just doesn't make it so. I mean, I can act like it's made in Germany, but it's not, or South Carolina. It's just a Ford, and I'm happy to have it. If you want to take up a special collection for a Mercedes, I'm okay with that as well. They don't keep Passover. They don't keep it a day later. They don't keep Passover. They keep a Seder meal, which is roughly has some elements of Exodus 12 in it. But Exodus 12, the lamb was to point to Jesus Christ. They don't accept Christ. They don't keep Passover. They keep it on a different day because it's not Passover. You can call it that, but it's not that. So you are not to eat the Lord's Supper, for in eating each one takes his own supper. This is apparently what was done maybe once or twice. One is hungry and another is drunk. It just had become a debacle, left to their own devices. Do you not have houses to eat and drink in, or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. Next verses. This is how you do it. Verse 23. And there's pretty good authority here, right? For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. They had been given this instruction. That the Lord Jesus, on the same night, that night began in the evening, that day began in the evening, it was the 14th of Nisan, or Abib, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed later after, you know, at the conclusion of the meal, Judas went out. That same night that he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat. This is my body. This is symbolic of my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. It's a memorial service. In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. New symbols for a new covenant for a spiritually led people. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. And we drink it every year on the anniversary of the date at the beginning of the 14th in the nighttime portion at the beginning of the day. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Now they had been taught from Exodus. They had been taught from Leviticus 23, where all the holy days are met. But here's another part of the preparation that goes beyond the physical. Verse 27, therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. So now the process of preparation and requires some introspection, requires some individualized attention and private, because it's possible to be doing this in an unworthy fashion, and you don't want that, right? But how do we get away from that unworthy fashion? Do you have to be perfect? No. Do you have to be without sin? Obviously not, because none of us are going to get there. It's a matter of prep time. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. It's positive. You must do it. You've got to do both. You've got to examine yourself, and you've got to follow through in these symbols, or you have no part with Jesus Christ. It's just like the foot washing. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body, being capricious about it as they were, being helter-skelter, or just doing it according to how you wanted to do it. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. If we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. So we do judge ourselves. We don't judge others. We don't condemn others. But we do judge our own actions and our own attitudes. And we do measure ourselves as to where we are in life and how respectful we are of that sacrifice and how meaningful the sacrifice of Jesus Christ really is to us. And we inspect ourselves and do that through the process of putting leaven out as well, which is another topic. But we put leaven out, and we're to put righteousness in by the symbol of unleavened bread, as we know. Verse 32, but when we are judged, we are chastened by the Lord, that we may not be condemned with the world. Sometimes it happens, right? Sometimes God judges us. And you know when God judges you. You know when you're wrong. You know the Spirit of God works with your own mind and helps you to understand, I did something wrong here. I'm in a bad attitude. I'm in a sinful attitude. I'm in a wrong frame of mind, and I need to change it. Verse 33, therefore, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. Not on the Passover, because that's already been eliminated in the earlier part of the verse. You know, I don't know if they had potlucks or if they called them then, but if you have a church meal, wait for one another, but it's not on the Passover. It doesn't say when you come together to eat Passover, wait for one another. It just do things in a dignified manner, in an organized manner, and take care of one another. Verse 34, that's cemented by saying, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, lest you come together for judgment, and the rest I'll set in order when I come. So in this passage, we see a number of things. I'm going to give you some bullet points. And you can outline this chapter yourself, but let me do it for you, and maybe I've missed something, I don't know. But we see several things that we should remember in our preparation for Passover this coming year. First of all, the Corinthians had been making many mistakes in their observance, just as ancient Israel had done. And ancient Israel and Judah, specifically the instances we've seen, just forgotten it altogether after a while, just stopped doing it because they absorbed too much of the culture of the nations that they were going to go into the promised land. And they shed the culture and tradition of the Bible, of the written word of Moses. And that was unfortunate. But they'd been making mistakes in their observance. And when you mess up your preparation and your observation, you risk forgetting the essential aspects of the Passover observance. A very real danger. As we see in Corinthians, it leads to division. Not good. We see that we're not to observe a dinner for Passover. It's not in the whole realm. We're to eat at home, but keep the Passover together as a church. He got that information directly, whether by vision or by personal visitation by Christ in Arabia. We don't know, but he got the same training level as the original apostles. Christ set the example of the bread and the wine and, of course, the foot washing. It's a memorial of his death. You need to conduct yourself appropriately. It's not the time of frivolity, laughing, visiting like we do on the Sabbath. But you need to be balanced, and that comes from your mental preparation. Going back to the Passover of about 1991, just a few short miles from here down at the Tucson Convention Center, we had made the announcement. I guess they had sent out maybe one of the announcements, maybe it was in our report from what we called headquarters or Pasadena at that time, that maybe sometimes people are too mournful and sad, and you know they kind of put on a sad face and kind of made the announcement, look, it's a optimistic time as well, and you know we have our sins forgiven and all that sort of thing. I was in the room across the hall preparing the wine, as we do. Usually the minister in charge gets the wine ready for all the glasses and all that sort of thing. We have a little thing. We put a tiny bit of wine in all these little cups you remember at the Passover, and I was doing that. And I don't know if somebody came in and told me, hey, you know, things are kind of getting out of hand in the hall there, or if I just noticed it myself. I can't remember, but everybody was talking and laughing and giggling, and I mean, this is before the Passover service. Everybody's talking and laughing and giggling, and, you know, it was like, it even seemed louder, I guess, because, you know, I'm in the mood here to conduct the service. Even seemed louder than normal Sabbath day service, so I had to go to the lectern and I said, everybody, let's remember. Okay, I made that announcement. Sorry, I made that announcement now on the Sabbath about how we don't have to be sad and, you know, overly sad and whatever. But let's get back to, this needs to be quieter. I mean, and then immediately everybody quieted down, but it was just not the right kind of preparation that night. I mean, Maybe I added to the confusion by reading whatever they sent to us, but anyway, we got it settled down. But we also realize that we cannot eat the bread and the wine in an unworthy fashion, and so we need to judge ourselves so that we're not condemned by God. And all of this takes time, thought, and preparation before you arrive at the Passover. And if you do it, you're going to do it with the right, confident attitude. But it is a sober time, so let's remember that. Not a time for visiting, joking, laughing, whatever. It's usually quieter, and just a gentle reminder there. Let's maybe mirror the attitudes of those who are presenting. When we present, we want to be hopeful, we want to be optimistic, we want to smile, but it is a memorial of the death of Jesus Christ, and it is sober and reflective for all of us as an individual. I remember my first Passover as an ordained minister. I wasn't employed by the church, but the pastor in Austin, Texas, had asked me to help with the service itself, and I think I may have done the first part of the service, and he did the second part, but that was my first Passover to serve in that capacity. I think, 1979, I would have been about 26, 27 at that time, 26, yeah, 26. And I was working in an outside sales job, and I was going to take off early to help prepare for that evening. And that's very important. I gave myself plenty of time. I'd been asked to take part of the service, and it was in Austin, Texas, and I had to make a U-turn under the interstate, Interstate 35, to go back home, and it just started to rain. And you know how it's when it just starts to rain, there's a little bit of oil in the on the asphalt, and then there's rain, and it rained enough so that it was kind of slippery, and a little more slippery than I had anticipated. And the upshot is that as I was going around making a left, I felt the rear end of the car, rear-wheel drive car, start to leave me, and it was going out to the right as I'm making this left-hand turn. And all of a sudden, I realized I don't have any control of this thing. And it was so bizarre. It's like one of those things that happens in slow motion. You know it's happening, but you can do nothing. You know, it seems like time has slowed down a little bit. And I just felt the car and the rear of the car just leave me, and it rammed right into a curb on the other side of the turn, and ruined a tire. And then I think some guy came in a truck and helped me. He saw the whole thing happen, and he was very sympathetic, but I was pretty nasty. I was dressed in a suit and jacket and everything, and here it's raining, and that was a real mess. You know, I had to go home completely changed everything. Hands are all black and everything from changing the tire. But I'm glad that I gave myself enough time to get to services and be able to prepare, and that is a part of our preparation as well, as you know, but... Then I'd like to take you to our first Passover in Rapid City. It was something I think maybe encouraging. I can't verify it, the authenticity of it. I know this event happened, but I'm not sure exactly why it happened. But I'll just throw it out. Stephen was 22 months old, our first Passover in Rapid City as the church pastor. And one of the other elders brought his teenagers over, who would not be attending Passover, obviously, to be babysitters. And, all the kids were staying together at our house. And we lived in a neighborhood, that first house that we had. It was probably all the lots were like 2 or 3 acres, and it wasn't developed with sidewalks and curbs and gutters and all that kind of thing. It was just, you know, in its raw development phase and gravel roads and all that kind of thing. So as a result, it wasn't like you could look over the fence and say hi to your neighbor. It was a long ways away. So people just didn't go up to people's houses and knock on the doors. I mean, pretty spread far apart. So we went to Passover, conducted the service, came home, and when we got home that evening, the teenagers told us that somebody had come to the door and knocked on the door, which was highly unusual. It never happened before and never has happened after any other time that we lived that. And they said, this man was dressed in a white suit. Which, again, is pretty unusual that somebody I can't remember what night the Passover was, or a Tuesday evening, Wednesday evening, or whatever that night, but it's very unusual that somebody just be wearing a white suit. I mean, white suits you don't see very often. But they distinctly remember the man came knocking on the door in a white suit, and the teens answered the door, and he simply said, is everything okay? Which again is really strange, right? So, anything else? No, we just told him everything was okay. And he turned around and left. And we could not believe it. I said, are you sure? A man in a white suit? And it was just a very odd, strange thing. Now, immediately what might come to your mind is, was it an angel? And that's what came to my mind. It could have been. I don't know. And maybe it's encouraging. Sometimes we do entertain angels unawares, and we don't know. And if you knew it was, then it wouldn't be unaware, right? So I don't know. But if it was, I would say I'm thankful that God looks after our children while we're away for Passover. Now I'd like to give another. I've got a few other personal examples that I want to relate to you regarding Passover. This one is about the last Passover in 1994 of Worldwide Church of God. It was not necessarily the beginning of great, great controversy, but it was toward the end of that time, and a lot of the controversy of those years had already begun. In the early 90s, for those of you that weren't around at that particular time, there was a questioning of our belief system that none of us had ever experienced before in our lives. Now, some of you have come along after that time. Some of you were there at that time. Some of you were part of that, and some of you were in other groups, and you've migrated over to this one. And by the way, advance warning, I'm not going to shy away from talking about that experience of 30 years ago. In fact, you're going to be hearing a lot about it, and I'm not going to make any apologies for it, because I'm saying it for the posterity and the verbal written record of the history of the Church of God. I think that it's my duty as a founding member of the General Conference of Elders to either remind or to bring to attention that if you're part of this group, you should know what its history is in the modern age, and that's why I'm doing it. I'm not doing it to go back and rehearse old wounds or anything else, but we can't forget the past, or else we might repeat some of those mistakes. But for about 3 or 4 years at least, leading up to that last Passover that many of us kept in Worldwide Church of God in 1994, there were a lot of questions about our practice. And one individual that I had considered a mentor in my earlier years in the church and in Ambassador College and even in the ministry began a dialogue, and he was trying to convince me that some of our practices and teachings regarding Passover were incorrect. Now, in those days, we didn't generally have email like everybody has today. There were other email systems, but there were corporate uses of email, and we had one that was called CC Mail. And this, you know, you're hooked up to your phone and your phone modem, and you would be hooked up, and then you would transmit it. You know, if you had a message that was a couple of pages long, it'd take 2 or 3 minutes to get there and download into the server. And this, we had this with all employees in the Church of God that was headquartered at Pasadena, California at this time. So I got into this dialogue, and I guess this individual thought he was going to wear me out with this new teaching that he was adhering to, but he didn't. I got into it hot and heavy with him over several weeks, and finally he just gave up on me. But what it prompted me to do was to really go back to the foundation of a lot of things and to dig it out. Like Ben Hogan said about his golf game, you got to dig it out of the dirt yourself. And I had to do that. Apart from any booklets or teaching or anything else, the Bible and maybe some commentaries, and I found and I proved that what we were doing was correct from the biblical standpoint. So finally, this notable minister gave up on me. He was one of the ones that was leading the charge of change during those years. Now, as for the 1995 Passover, we met at the School for the Deaf and Blind. And I remember distinctly Ken Garreau. He's probably watching online, but I really believe that he was next to me during the foot washing, or maybe he and I even washed each other's feet, but Ken was there. And what happened during that evening was nothing sensational or anything. But to give you an idea of what was happening leading up to that last Passover in 1995, I may have said 94, I meant 95, I'd conducted several meetings with the deacons, the deaconesses, the elders, and their wives over at a local hotel. It used to be called the Windmill Hotel at Campbell and River. Now it's a Hilton property, but we use that facility for Bible studies a lot. And I held a lot of deacons meetings during those months. And what that taught me, and you know, just meeting with the deacons and elders, I just put on the blackboard, okay, here's what we have taught traditionally, and here's what we're teaching, here's what the church is teaching now. And in just getting the people to discuss it among themselves, I was crafty like a fox. Just getting them to discuss it, I began to see where their loyalties lay. It just was very, very clear. I knew who I could depend on, and I knew who was embracing the new ideas, the new traditions, and I'll just call them for what they were, heresies. And that was kind of scary to me, because in the space of just a few short years, just like at Corinth, some heresies and problems had developed. We had the communication constantly, which I allowed, but it was a good thing, as I'll be explaining throughout the coming weeks and even months till we get to the time of Pentecost. In my own case, also in addition to that, I'd conducted a written survey that I administered to all of my churches in August of 1994, and I've talked about this before, but I basically was doing a survey with 20 or 30 or 40 questions about, do you agree, disagree, strongly agree, blah, blah, blah. And all of it was designed to test whether the individual was consistent in understanding what we needed to do, why we needed to keep the Sabbath, why we needed to keep the holy days. And that evening, Terry can tell you, we got on the living room floor, spread the papers out, began reading through results and tabulating it. And I was shocked beyond belief and discouraged beyond belief, because I found out that many in our congregation did not feel that keeping the Passover, the Sabbath, and the holy days was an essential part of their faith. And it was shocking. So by the time of the Passover, with these deacon elders meetings and that survey behind me, I determined to resign my employment from the church, because I'd very clearly seen that the church corporation had been hijacked by some and changed the practice. When you change practice, you run a risk and a danger. And I'd learned that several of the deacons and the elders had accepted the changes initiated by the leadership of Worldwide Church of God, and based on my attendance at a ministerial conference in Santa Barbara of 1994 in December, I saw that the leader of the entire church was defiant and was not going to change. The course had been laid, the Sabbath was no longer holy, and shortly after the holy days and the Passover, everything would be basically done away, which it was. And I saw that in person with hundreds of other ministers and wives at that time in Santa Barbara. So for that Passover of 1995, I had anticipated issues and problems. I conducted the service by myself. There are members that were confused at that time, very, very confused, because their headquarters was changing the teaching and the doctrine and the practice of what they had accepted. Some were discouraged. Some didn't show up at the Passover at all. They knew a little bit of what was going on. They didn't know all that I knew. Some didn't attend. They didn't know what to do. Some accepted it. The members who had already rejected the precepts of our faith did attend that evening, and they went through the motions. It was obvious to me that their hearts weren't really in it. They were doing it by rote. Within the next year, most of those who remained in that corporate body did not keep the Passover or even keep any other holy days. Certainly changed their practice. It was a time of crisis, not like the time of Judas' betrayal of crisis. I'm not saying that. But it was a time of crisis for everyone that was associated with the Church of God at that time. So let's go to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 19 as we are getting close to concluding this. Matthew 26 and verse 19, it says, "So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. And when evening had come, he sat down with the 12, and now as they were eating, he said, 'Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.' And they were," in verse 22, "they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each one of them began to say to him, 'Lord, is it I?' And he answered and said, 'He who dips his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born.' Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, 'Rabbi, is it I?' And he said to him, 'You have said it.'" Yep. Now, can we say that Judas didn't prepare himself for Passover? Yeah. He was a thief. He'd already had a bad attitude, probably thought that, you know, this is not the vision that I had of the Messiah. This is not what I expected from a Messiah. Got disgruntled, got upset, got in a bad attitude. And we're going to close with one of the most important lessons of the New Testament. And it does apply to Passover. And it did apply to that Passover in 1995. And virtually every split and departure from the faith, no matter how big or how small, you're going to find this at the heart of it. Guaranteed. It's very important. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15. This is a part of Passover preparation. It could be a part of preparation every day. Hebrews 12 and verse 15 says, "Looking carefully," this is preparation, "lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled." This is at the origin of every schism, split, and division of the faith. Of the faith. You'll find us. Bad feelings, hard feelings, sore feelings. People begin to look elsewhere. And one person, it says, can have an influence on many. Bitterness and envy are brothers. And just like Judas, when they inhabit one person, and they do, in the mind, it can destroy minds and lead people away from the truth. Their field and their harvest are confusion and faithfulness, but it often masquerades and parades itself as, "Hey, wait a minute, they haven't told you everything," just like at the Garden of Eden. God has, what, he didn't tell you you'd live forever? Are you kidding me? Told you you're not going to die. They're keeping it from you. It takes many forms, but it's very deadly. Sometimes it comes as advanced knowledge. It's one of the most destructive of all heresies of the late first century, as you'll be able to read in many passages. Now, some of the ideas may change slightly, but the modus operandi is the same, or the method of operation. It ends in the same. The individual cannot recognize their own confusion, their own life. And did that happen to Judas? And will Judas ever live again? Is he consigned forever to death? Well, I would tend to believe he did not have God's Holy Spirit. He was not called at that time. Just a personal feeling. Yeah, okay, say if we disagree, maybe, but he did a bad thing. You know what? He caused the death of Jesus Christ. And you know what? So did you and me. We all fit in that category. Brethren, our process is correct. We follow the instructions of the Bible. Unlike the Jews who allowed themselves to be lax in their preparation, then at the times they did keep Passover, they needed the help of the priesthood to be able to get it right a little bit. They didn't do it according to the original instructions. And since they've allowed themselves to ignore that instruction, by the time of the New Testament and Jesus' time, no way would some of them receive the New Testament instruction from Jesus himself, and they haven't, by and large. Let's make sure that we prepare for the Passover this year, 2025, in humility and faith.